My name is Jürgen Kocker. I'm a historian here in Berlin. And my first time of contact with Fulbright was in the year 1964, when I got a travel grant to the United States. And I should mention that at that time, it was still cheaper to go by boat than by plane.
Ah.
So I had the pleasure to go within the Fulbright group on the MS Bremen from Bremerhaven to New York and on the MS Berlin back.
Okay, very good. Professor, if you could also tell us, we'd like to ask each person to do this as well, what you think the most important political development has been in the past 25 years. I'm asking you to think on your feet here for a second.
Clearly, the end of communism, the fall of the wall, the end of the Cold War.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Gil Carbajal. I had my Fulbright from United States, from Stanford University to Madrid, Spain, 1974 and 75, to study history, Spanish history. But I subsequently converted to a journalist, which is instead of studying the past, I focused on the present or the ongoing present. I think the most important development for transatlantic, at least for transatlantic relations, besides the fall of the wall, of course, was so important. I think the selection by the Supreme Court of George W. Bush in 2000 had a tremendous impact on transatlantic relations and, of course, led, number one, facilitated the attack on September 11th, and also led to the invasion of Iraq and the tremendous division between Europeans and Americans about the justice of that war.
Okay, thank you.
My name is Ilga Pullman. I'm now, I must say, politician, since I'm a member of the German Bundestag since now almost 25 years. I have to say I'm a politician. I've held numerous positions in the German parliament, and I was a minister for education, research and technology for 7 years. I'm not a Fulbright fellow, but I've been to the US in numerous times, and I have visited the U.S. very often, not only because I'm very interested in that country, but because also my husband lived quite a long time in the U.S., and we had a transatlantic marriage for more than 6 years. So, and I was already a member of the German parliament, so I stayed in Germany because I always said I can't shift my seat to the Congress, and he couldn't do the other way around.
He could if he could provide a birth certificate.
No, he had his dream job in the U.S. and I had my dream job in Germany. But it was a successful cooperation, transatlantic cooperation and marriage, and that is a symbol, I think, for the transatlantic cooperation between our discussions. Let me just add one thought. When I listened to the discussion, which took part just a couple of minutes ago. I very often thought this is a perception from the view of a politician who has worked for a long time in foreign policy. Because when I look at the transatlantic cooperation from the point of view of research, science, and higher education, then I can only say that we have a very, very strong and dense net of personal relations and cooperations between Germany and the U.S., and that is which is very stable and well-woven, and I think which is very strong as well. And therefore, when we talk about the role, for example, of education and higher education, as well as science, I think we are talking about the future, and we are talking about a very solid foundation in the relation between our two countries.
Thank you very much.
Oh, you shouldn't have. My name's Bill Ashcroft. I'm from Australia. I'm not a Fulbrighter. I'm holding the Armorica Chair in Australian Studies at University of Kern. I was invited by Ben Becker. And I may have not much to say. I had a five-minute paper, but it wasn't about transatlantic relations. But I would say that the last 25 years have seen an increase in a very old truth, and that is that capitalism, the modernity itself, is cultural. And we think of modernity as Western, and we have this triumphalist idea that the transatlantic dominance of the world is something that's always been. What I want to suggest is that just as modernity is cultural, it is multiple. And modernity issues from multiple sites in the world today. And these sites will need to be taken notice of by transatlantic relations. And of course, we know that the center of gravity of capitalism has shifted to the east and not the west, and we'll need to take that into account. But wherever that center of gravity shifts, we will have to take account of the fact that modernity is cultural, and that cultural identity is itself multiple.
Stanisław Kluza. I am from Poland. I was a Fulbrighter in 1999 and 2000. I am from the field of economics and quantitative methods. Now I work in a Polish Financial Supervision Authority. Coming to the question about the crucial issues from the Polish perspective, of course, it is the iron curtain. It changed all the economic relations, not only in Poland, but also in the whole region of Central Eastern Europe, not only in the whole region of the Central Eastern Europe, but also in the whole Europe. It changed the philosophy a little bit of the whole European Union. From the transatlantic relations, I would say that the crucial issue was just that this disappeared, the conflict between the so-called Eastern and Western bloc. So I think that something that was a conflict in the past, it simply doesn't exist. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. First of all, I would like to congratulate the German Alumni Association on your 25th anniversary. So happy anniversary all. My name is Hassan Mekwar, and it looks like I'm the only one from one part of the world, the South and the whole Arab Crescent.
I'm further south.
Oh, but I consider Australia as north. Mentally, mentally it's north. Picasso, you know, Cubism. Wiltrud, when you were kind enough to invite me, you actually you got three for the price of one. I am a Fulbright alumnus. I had two degrees, two Fulbrights, one in 68. Which I got in Ohio, in Athens, Ohio. And the second one was for a PhD at Brown University. And this is my first hat, if you like, or the first term of definition. The second one, I've been involved with the equivalent of the German Commission for 27 years. For 27 years, I've been a member of the board of the commission, and also several times for seven mandates, I was president of that association. So the Fulbright program and me are pretty, I mean, at least in that part of the world, it's something else. And the third hat, if you like, is the fact that we created with a few friends, the Moroccan Fulbright Alumni Association about 10 years ago. And I'm happy to see that many of you participated in the powwow we had in Marrakesh a few years back. My answer to what happened, the most important factor, I would consider from my side of the world, two points, I would say. The first one is globalization, which, of course, because of even the term globalization, includes and especially impacts parts of the world like Morocco. And the second one would be something that we are living every day by watching television, and it's this concept of this concept of democratic transition or democratization. And particularly in my country and the neighboring countries of Tunisia and Egypt and so on. This is a process that has started, had been launched, and with different speeds and different results. And in Morocco, I keep touching wood, probably the process will be achieved by the end of this year in a smooth and nonviolent manner.
Thank you very much. Probably think people in Morocco, if they're listening to this, watching this, can take comfort in that, because I think in lots of countries in Northern Africa, people would like to have that sense of peaceful reform and peaceful change. So very heartening to hear you say that. Thank you.
Because we'll have a chance in the panel the evening to talk about it, so I'll develop a little bit more about that.
Okay, good. Okay, thank you very much, Hassan. You actually, Hassan, are helping us for the next phase of this discussion, and that is to move into the present and the future, where we're headed. And let me ask Professor Kalka, I'm going to give you an easy question, Professor. Where is the world headed?
You know that historians are not responsible for the future, but for the past.
Yeah.
Well, I think I don't believe in fast ruptures. They are rare. By and large, trends which have existed over the last 25 years tend to continue. In a modified form, yes, but not in changes from one day to the next. What were the trends? Basically, I agree with Hildegard Bullmann that there is a lot of close contact, continuity, collegiality, tense cooperation between Germans and Americans. Certainly in my field I teach, now I'm working as a visiting professor at UCLA regularly, and this is the major thing, and I think this will continue. But on the other hand, over the last 25 years, in certain ways, the distances and the differences have grown between Europe and North America, between Germany and the United States. And you asked for the most important event. If I have three, I say three. The fall of the wall, 1989 to 1991. Secondly, 9/11. And thirdly, the Great Recession between 2008 and 2010. May I, 1 minute. I mean, the end of communism, the end of the Cold War, in a way, increased the unity in the world. After all, it was not anymore a split situation, and somebody even spoke of the end of history. But certainly, a lot of cooperation continued, and between Germans and Americans, the United States had played such an important role in unification, a positive role in German unification, and many Germans were aware of that. On the other hand, the end of the Cold War removed the common enemy, the common threat, the common challenge from the East. And this has enlarged Spielräume, scopes of action. And it is on this background that there is more self-assurance in the long run, more tendency to stress one's own identity versus vis-a-vis the Americans in this country. And so in the long run, this change of 1989-91 has made it possible that divergences appeared again. Secondly, 9/11. Certainly it was a challenge to the West in many ways, to Western culture. It was perceived as such, and the war on terror was declared to be an international phenomenon. On the other hand, it happened to the United States, to New York and Washington. And in spite of London and in spite of Madrid, it did not happen to the same degree in Europe, and certainly not in this country. And so certain cultural differences which exist anyway between the United States and Germany have been reinforced by this event, by this threat, by this catastrophe. There is more acceptance of harsh measures, of punishment, of violence, of weapons in the United States than in this country. And there is more feeling for the need of responsibility over one's borders, beyond one's borders. And this is much less so in the United States. There is a beautiful book by a colleague of mine, Jim Sheehan, Where Are All the Soldiers Gone, is the title. And he writes about the tremendous change in Western Europe between the late 19th century and the early 21st century. Militarization going back, demilitarization taking place. You wouldn't say that about the United States. And thirdly, the Great Recession, 2008 to 2010, again, a common challenge to most advanced industrial or post-industrial systems. But it was dealt with differently in the different countries. Germans did rather well, better than the Americans. And this has helped to challenge a basic belief which had existed over the last 20 years, namely that the Anglo-American model of capitalism is clearly superior, and that in the long run, the continental European model of a more coordinated, more organized capitalism would have to be changed in order to adjust to the market radical model of the Anglo-Americans. Now, this belief is deeply shattered. And the crisis should be read and can be read and is read by many as a deep challenge to neoliberalism. And as a consequence, it will be more difficult to speak of one best practice in economic behavior and in capitalism. And again, we have a certain legitimization of divergence, legitimization of difference. And so I think this will continue. Increasing globalization and increasing entanglement, yes. But this does not mean convergence and increasing homogenization. And I think this will be the future, not only the past.
That's a very brave notion of the future, Professor. I think some people want to give you applause. Let me ask the other panelists if they agree with that.
I think if you're looking for about the future, the threat of neoliberalism is alive and well in the corporate structure of the United States, the financial structure, which has led to an enormous gap. And this is a crisis for our younger generations. The power acquisition. You know, when I went to university, I had it pretty much financed, thanks to the National Defense Education Act. Today, students finish their degrees terribly indebted, and this of course causes them, especially in this is the United States, because in Europe the American dream is being realized. There is a social network and education is not so expensive. So neoliberalism has had a nefarious effect, and I go back again to the election of 2000, because imagine an Al Gore very conscious of climate change and the difference that would have made for the world and the difference that would have made for ecology and energy. Neoliberalism is a great threat to the future, to future generations, because unless these corporations who have been unfettered so far are regulated again, because we've seen that process of deregulation has led to this as a factor in the financial crisis, unless the corporations are reined in, and unless we all mobilize to improve the environment and to decrease the causes of global warming. And Germany is a great example in this. And I'm always delighted to come here and see all the containers with their different compartments to put everything. It's always a pleasure to see that here is an example that must be followed even in Spain and in the United States. But I am rather pessimistic right now about the future because of those two factors.
Okay. Ms. Bowman, what do you say, particularly about this notion of education being a commodity under neoliberalism?
I wouldn't say neoliberalism will fade away. I would say it is challenged much more stronger than it was 4 or 5 years ago. But I wouldn't say it will fade away, because the struggle is still going on. And education is one example where we have the tradition in Europe, but we had also the tradition in the US that access for education should be possible for everybody, and not only for a small number of the population. It was organized in a different way in both our countries and regions. But nevertheless, you are right. In the US, at least access to higher education is much more difficult at the moment than it was 20 years ago or 25 years ago. So that has really changed. I think there are also, I think, similarities. And this doesn't have to do so much with neoliberalism, but with our traditions and cultures. I think in both our countries, education is highly valued, still highly valued, and I hope this will stay. And I think this value is accepted in both of our countries for the personal development, for the development of the individual. It is also acknowledged that a good qualification of human resources, and or that human resources are especially important for our economic progress. And when in the discussion we took part before our discussion, it was underlined that the German industry is very competitive. Then I would say yes, it is very competitive, but this very strongly depends on the qualification level of our people, and that is true for my country, but this is also true for the US. And in both of our countries, we have to meet challenges, because in Germany, we have on one hand a very highly qualified workforce, but on the other hand, we have an increasing number of people, young people, who are not qualified at all. Mm-hmm. That's the same situation in the US. Mm-hmm. You have on one hand a very highly qualified workforce, but you have an increasing number of people who are not very well qualified. And when I look at Asia, and I think that's a difference when we talk about, you know, periods. When I look back 25 years ago, the situation in the Asian countries was totally different. When I go there, and I was just last week in Vietnam, and no matter whether I'm talking about Vietnam, whether I'm talking about Korea, whether I'm talking about China, those countries undertake strong efforts to increase the quality of their educational system and to increase the qualification level of their people. And therefore, we must put much more effort in the improvement of our qualification and our education system. And I know what I'm talking about because I introduced several, you know, changes in our education system, and that is always very different. But again, I think we must keep and try to improve the high level of our qualification system, but we must especially take more care and must undertake more efforts to decrease the number of people with a very low qualification level, because that is one of our major problems in both of our countries. And coming back to the question of neoliberalism, one can, of course, you know, I always say, have a sort of intellectual laziness to accept the situation. And some people in our country, as well as in the US, just accept this situation. But I think as a Fulbright fellow, but also at a Fulbright meeting, one has to think the unthinkable. One has to dare to think the unthinkable. And I'm quite sure that we have the opportunity, we have the ability to improve the situation. And therefore, I would say these are the two major tasks: to keep this high level, to improve it step by step still, of our higher education, of our secondary school system, but to take special efforts to improve the educational situation for those who are disadvantaged and who have a very low education level at the moment.
Thank you very much. It's interesting you use the term intellectual laziness. I was at a reception in Washington a couple of weeks ago, and a very famous neocon, neoliberal, said to me, "Oh, you live in Germany, where education is free. That is a perfect breeding ground for lazy intellectuals because they never have to pay for the education they get." Interesting.
It's wrong. If you're a child of 5 or 10 years, you're not able to pay for your own education. Yeah. And that's nonsense.
But it was interesting that he said that. Yeah, he associated that with Germany as soon as I said that. Anyway. But it was an interesting reception. Bill, let's go to you.
Yeah, could I just say that we perhaps mistake U.S. neoliberalism for global capitalism, and that's probably a mistake. What's neoliberalism? It's the idea that the market should never be interfered with. The market will always right itself. That was absolutely shown to be false with the Wall Street crash. America learned that people who are making billions on Wall Street need to be controlled because greed can run rampant. The market doesn't adjust itself. And I think America is exceptional in the degree to which it trusts the market. And it's that kind of position is ameliorated considerably in other countries such as Germany. But I would like to make the point that, yes, I think things will change. I don't think neoliberalism will, you know, somehow erode away. But what will happen is that a multi-centric modernity, a multi-centric globalization, will see a very different world economy. And I suspect a greater awareness of different cultures and a greater interaction between them. It's some people would say that 9/11 is probably the most significant event of the last 25 years for the world. But, you know, I can tell you that that is not true for the whole rest of the world. 9/11 makes little impact on a very large part of the world. And I think when we're talking about transatlantic relations, we do well to think about a very large part of the world for which these relations perhaps don't have any meaning.
Stanislav, let me ask you, what about Poland? Isn't Poland a great example of a country that has prospered tremendously with a good dose of neoliberalism?
It's quite a complex question. Well, I think Poland, I would say, a little different. It was different at the beginning of the crisis from many developed economies. First, it was less developed, so it was not touched by the crisis so much. On the other hand, Poland was developing a little bit more under the pressure of the crisis that had extremely strong crisis exactly at the end of the 80s, at the beginning of 90s. So in Poland, there were created some very specific and unique safety buffers that in this crisis, they simply worked. Poland is not that big country, so that is not a big example that could be copied by some other countries. But for example, in the area of the financial sector, Poland had some quite unique solutions that they simply worked. But coming to the general questions that you asked about the neoliberalism and both in the area of financial sector and in education, maybe I can comment them as well. Neoliberalism, it's the question about the market, about the free market, and it's extremely important to recognize freedom of the financial relations and open market from the irresponsibility. There is also additional economic term that is very necessary to add, that is the issue of the public good. Let's compare two markets and the freedom of two markets, that is a financial sector market and that is a potato market. If there is a potato market and we have a freedom at the potato market and there is a kind of tension at the potato market, doesn't matter whether it's a supply shock, demand shock, whatever, we have one supplier less. One supplier has bankrupt. If we have a financial sector, if one financial institution, big financial institution, will fail, it will have consequences that all the financial institutions will go to the trouble because of the contingency effect. So that are not exactly the same markets. So the question is, what is the stability at each of those markets? At the potato market stability, it's just a typical quantitative stability that we can derive from those all those charts, and we find equilibrium. That's a stability at the market, potato market. But stability at the financial sector market, it is a public good. If it is a public good, it is not a freedom like we have at the potato market. It is a kind of good that should be regulated by the state. It means that the state should define the rules of the game at the market, and the state, because who will pay the consequences for the crisis? At the potato market, all the consequences are paid by the owner of this potato company. This company failed, this company paid. If at the financial sector one bank will go to the bankruptcy, the banks, they do not deal with their own money. They deal with money, with the money of the public, with the people's money. So if they will go to bankruptcy, it means that finally just the taxpayers will pay. So the state should define the rules of the game to defend the taxpayers' interests from the badly defined freedom of the market relations at the market. So it means that this market always will be regulated, and the question is which way to regulate, not to kill the market, but to allow to grow, to allow to develop, to be good for the economy, but on the other hand, not to be irresponsible. That's about the question about the neoliberalism at the financial sector, and about the education. I think that with education has one thing in common with financial sector. It also touches the issue of the public good. But there is one thing that, from me, from my point of view, for Europe is more dangerous, for the European Union, I would say. That's the issue of the demographic shift. For example, if we have the fertility ratio, I would say close to 1.5 in Europe on average, it means that the generation of the children will be 30% less numerous than the generation of parents. So it means that we have a generation gap of nearly 30%. The question is which way to cover this generation gap. This generation gap will, after a few years, after several 10, 20, 30 years, will be pushed to the labor market. And that's the question about this gap, how much we can cover from the technological innovation, how much is it possible to cover from the shift from, let's say, enlarging the working age, for example, but also the question is how big deficit at the job market will occur, especially in so-called professional segments. And I think it will be extremely difficult to cover. This is the issue of the whole European Union, I would say. That's a weak remark. Maybe it was possible to develop some of those issues.
Thank you very much, Stanislav. Hassan, we come to you as the final one. I mean, we've given you a lot of fodder for thought here. Demographics, you're on the other end of the demographic line in Northern Africa. And I'd like to ask you, you know, Bill picked up on this topic of modernity. What does modernity mean in Morocco right now?
Oh, actually, before I approach your question, I need to make a couple of points. This is a very small economy and it's a developing country. And you spoke about 25 years before and 25 years. So I'm looking at like a context of half a century. And I'm seeing, for example, that this concept of emergence or globalization has had an impact on the country, and a considerable impact But the impact with an increase in a number of sectors that the government chose to support, textile, for example, and a few others, this has an impact, but the impact has been profoundly unequal. The benefits of globalization, the benefits of free market, the benefits of all these things that you're familiar with in this part of the world have reached only an infinitely small proportion of the population. And the result has been a growth of poverty, even as the proportion of people becoming richer from the benefits of globalization. In one particular sector, before I get back to your question, in one sector, for example, the sector of education, this concept of globalization has been seeping in. So those small proportions of people benefiting from the growth, benefiting from globalization, have been sending their kids abroad, have been putting their kids in private schools at home or in other countries. The large proportion of students go to the public system, which has been growing and has become, over the past 25 years, a machine that produces unemployed people. And you have to understand that it is these unemployed people over 25 years, without jobs, without prospects, that are provoking the revolution that we're experiencing all over the Arab world. Because no matter how much GDP and all this richness, this money coming in, the country and how much the figures of the World Bank and all these things, they are still, each family still has people your age, 30, 25, without jobs and desperate to find anything. And the problem is, even if the World Bank and other organizations point to Dudua, they point, it change your system of education, they tell us. The system of education is the most difficult thing to change, because you have to change both the teachers and the students. And the teachers are the first. And the academics are the most conservative, the most hard to change. And I can speak to you again from experience of many, many years. They do not want to change. And whenever you open your mouth, they tell you, this is America. They have the money. This is Europe. We are a special case. Now, what was your question?
In the meantime. My question was, why are academics so liberal?
No, I'm saying academics. I'm saying academics are not liberal. Academics are adamant, resistant to change.
Yeah.
I had the experience as a Fulbrighter with all these ideas, in a position in which I could propose a change that would give more freedom, more autonomy to universities, give more responsibility so that professors are not just functionaries and they get paid no matter how much they work or how little they work, and that all professors are the same level. I tried to change every time I had the whole thing against me, so it was a failure. Professors are functionaries. They are civil servants. They get the same money whether they work or not. And it is really the problem we have. Thank you.
Wow. Thank you very much. Yeah, everyone's awake, I see. Are there any questions out there? I mean, this is a very rich panel group here. There have to be tons of questions for these people. Who would like to start us off?
Could I just ask a question while we're warming up? And I just wonder if, as Hassan said, all these people without jobs, these educated people over 25, are starting revolutions. But is this possibly the sign of a different localized modernity emerging in the Middle East?
We have to combine the fact that we have a core of unemployed, frustrated, fed by globalization because they have access to everything. Whereas a generation before, there was one channel, one television channel, now 1,000 television channels. These people simply complained, but nothing happened. Now they have access to a world which is globalized. They can see what's happening. And also they can communicate with each other. And it's called a Facebook revolution. In Arab, we use them. The word Facebook has become an Arabic word, and a verb and a pronoun and everything. They Facebook, which means that anyone in this category who has any kind of problem can simply project that problem to in front of 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 others who can see themselves. after Bouazizi burnt himself in Tunis, near Tunis, a few months ago, and provoked the Tunisian revolution, we had a lot of people trying to burn themselves in Morocco. But the second, who was the first to get on the moon? The second. Who was the first to cross the Atlantic? The second, after Lindbergh. History doesn't care about the second. History only cares about the first, and historians will agree with me. A lot of people try to burn themselves, but because of this knowledge, there have been preparations. People can get crazy, or people can be all kinds of things. So the first three or four were accidents, but then by that time, of course, the thing has passed. But I was really saying that our kind of revolution is, I hope, it's fixing to be a peaceful one and a smooth one, because the king, who had inherited all his power, the powers of his father, wanted to really push, while he still has the power, democratization, which cannot be just simply launched, thrown at the rabble, because if you throw democracy at the rabble will tear it up, like a hungry, you know, and there will be no democracy. So I know what I'm talking about. Thank you very much.
Do we have questions? Okay, oh, good. One here, this gentleman, and the gentleman on this side too, second.
Mr. McCourt, would Britain be a good role model for your country, where you still have a king or a queen, but you have democracy as well?
Well, I'll be speaking about that, because this is the central issue. The king said, change the constitution, and these are the seven principles. And everyone agrees on the seven principles because they're synthetic principles. Rights, human rights, and etc. Rights of assembly, the rights. Secondly, a parliament, which the separation of powers. Thirdly, a strong government elected from parliament and from elections, which has the real executive powers, and that a number of principles like this. So everyone is saying that the king himself is advocating a parliamentary monarchy. This is what is happening now. How much it is going to, what kind of result will emerge in June, I'll keep for this afternoon and give some floor to my friends.
The man behind you. You've got the microphone. But go ahead and ask yours then. Okay.
Just something more on December 14, 2000, which was highlighted as one of the major events of the last year.
Yes, well, that was the Supreme Court decision to stop the recount of votes in Florida. And this was a conservative, usually the conservative judges defend state rights, and they violated their own ideology. And it was, of course, one vote. It was probably Sandra Day O'Connor who gave the presidency to George W. Bush, with all the enormous consequences for the world we have today. Number one, his administration was very lax in following the Al-Qaeda and persecuting the terrorist leads, as we all know. And then, of course, his absolute military solution. I don't have to go on to the consequences because we all know them well, and we're still suffering them today in Afghanistan. But it is interesting that this court stopped, that the state was perfectly capable of recounting. They just needed the time. And there was no reason to interfere with that process. And there was a very prominent attorney, Bugliosi in California, famous for prosecuting the Manson people, wrote a Republican at the time, wrote this book saying those justices should be impeached for violating their oaths of office. They really did interfere where they should not have interfered. And that has had a tremendous impact on the world we live today in so many areas.
I would like to get back on the issue of neoliberalism and globalization. And what I've learned from you is you all basically, I think, agreed that the markets were not able to regulate themselves during the crash. Who's going to regulate global markets? Who's going to regulate global commodities like education if the European Union is not even able to come up with a common foreign policy, for example, for Europe? How is that happening? Where are these values derived from that will actually be needed to run a future global economy, a global market, a global education. How do we go about this? What's your take on that? To all of you.
Well, I think it was mostly about me, because I was saying that the market will never regulate themselves. Even I would say the stronger that we have a failure of self-regulations of the markets, and this simply this failed. And we can see from this crisis. The question is about the origin of the crisis. We can see the end. Sometimes it is global, sometimes it is regional, sometimes it is across country. But where is the origin? Origin of every crisis is local, is very local. On the averages, if you look from a very, very high perspective, on average, men and the horse, they have three legs, on average. So the question is how to avoid the average, how to go to the details, to recognize the details, and to not allow the financial institutions for all the shifts within the balances, just to move assets, to transfer assets, to hide assets, to put something under the carpet. No, just it's necessary to have off-site and on-site inspections. It's necessary to have locally imposed so-called buffers for liquidity and buffers for capital, buffers for liquidity norms and capital. So it means that having very close relation to the financial market players, you can capture them. So it means that most of the power and responsibility should be at a very, very local level. But of course, at the end, we have still most and more and more globalized international relations. And we can see the result of the last. We can see the result of the last few years' work. There were created three European agencies, so-called the agency for the banking sector, agency for the supervising insurance sector, and capital markets. And they have one additional specific role, that this role is just to coordinate, just to have just to exchange information, because you can be close to the company at the local level, but finally you have to aggregate and to know about the overall situation from a top as well, but manage from the bottom up, not top down. That's the answer according to the details about so-called how to design the new framework that will be maybe a little better.
Look, I'd agree with that, that it should be bottom-up, but I think your question goes a bit further. I mean, you know, America tried to reintroduce the Glass-Steagall Act, but couldn't because of British policy, British economic policy. And the Britons said, if you do this, it'll be an act of war. So the question is, it's certainly what the crisis revealed is that globalization theory, which said the nation is ended, was wrong. You know, the nation has a responsibility in the regulation of markets, but what about global regulation? There has to be some international agreements, and maybe this is where the next 25 years could see a very strong development of financial and economic regulations between Europe and America. But, you know, I'm not holding my breath, because there's two very, very fundamentally different cultures as far as economics are concerned. But, you know, your question is a good one, because it's all right for nations to regulate these financial markets, but what about globally?
What I'd also like to answer, because I think it's important to look at those regulation sets, international regulation sets we already have. Because if somebody says it's not possible to set up an international acknowledged regulation frame, I would say he's wrong. Because we have international regulation frames. We have the WTO, the World Trade Treaty, which is not enough. And it was designed and shaped for the 80s, not for a globalized world. But nevertheless, we have it and we improve it step by step. But we have also international treaties. We have the Treaty for International Labor Regulation, ILO. Yeah. We don't talk about it very much, but we have it. And most of the countries are part and subscribed this international regulation. We have the Kyoto Protocol. Of course, not everybody signed this Kyoto Protocol, but nevertheless, it was a start which was very important, not only for creating awareness, but to act, to be pragmatic and to, you know, make contribution in order to change our system of energy supply. So we have international treaties, for example, for our international seas. Very complicated frame set, but nevertheless it works, and it works regularly, and it has been working since a long time. And I'm not talking about security policy. We will also have this international frame set. So we have for the financial market, and I want to mention this, Basel II and Basel III, which of course is an improvement with regard to, you know, the situation as it was even before this financial crisis. The question is always, on one hand, how far can we go and what can we reach? And that is a result of negotiations. And that's why I'm personally so convinced that it's absolutely necessary to, you know, in order to improve the quality of these international treaties, you must have, that is my political experience, you must have 2, 3, 5 countries who go forward. Well, when I look at also the treaties I signed and designed and shaped and so on, I always looked for 2, 3 countries who supported this treaty. And then you are successful. And that's the same on the international level. And that, of course, means we have to negotiate, of course. And you will very often get a compromise, not very, you know, satisfying for yourself. So you get step by step. And I think Jürgen Kocka is right when he says very often we have an evolutionary process, not a revolution, but an evolutionary process. And you have drawbacks. But nevertheless, you know, I think it's worthwhile to undertake these efforts to negotiate, to improve this international framework set. And what we are discussing at the moment, you know, not only to stick to Basel II and Basel III, but to set up a parallel or additional frame via the international, the IVF, for example, that of course is also worthwhile. And therefore, I don't belong to that group of people who say it's impossible. I think it's very hard work, and it takes a lot of patience and a lot of resistance. But it can be done, not in one big gesture that maybe is sometimes possible in a certain window of time. You have to use this window of opportunity, but very often it's a very, you know, difficult step-by-step approach. But let's look at these international treaties we already have and try to set up similar sets of regulations for other areas.
Yes, and to elaborate on Stanislaw's from the bottom up, and to give a response to your question of what's to be done, it is grassroots activity. It is the people. It is we here assembled and are concerned.
You must do both.
Concerned about the issues, but the greatest, one of the greatest things lacking, of course, is galvanizing people to action. We have it now in Wisconsin because of the attack on the labor movement, especially the it's the Republican strategy to undermine the Democratic Party, because it's so their important base is the labor union. But people, Republicans and independents, are outraged at this very, very gross attempt to limit workers' rights. The workers have responded. The grassroots has responded because their livelihood is at risk. But we have these long-term risks. The Fulbright program in the United States is under attack. Republicans don't like education, and they don't want the masses to be educated. And I'm afraid, I'm showing my true colors, but at least in the policies being advocated
by the current trend. And so they attack the Fulbright program. They attack public radio. They attack all sources that contradict their message. And whereas the liberals, we all believe in everybody expressing their opinion and reaching consensus. But the great challenge is to get people motivated and active to tackle these problems of global warming and financial regulation. These things are so far from people's lives, but they don't understand.
But they understand the effects.
Exactly. But somehow there has to be a threat before they move to action. The threat to the Fulbright program, we all start writing to our congressmen. But somehow, I think the only way is association with pressure groups and with political parties to change. But how do we convince people to do this?
Well, I just want to say, I agree with the very social democratic approach by Hildegard Bullmann. There's not much else to do. And I think it's not, there is success possible. But I just want to say, this panel, if you had it in the United States, it probably would sound different. There is this slight consensus that we better have a bit more regulation.
That's right.
And you even used the word liberal in a positive sense.
Yeah.
Now, you know, we always read and hear that the political discussion in the United States is highly polarized and dichotomized, and they can't get any more onto each other in terms of compromise. That's true if you look to Washington and the Congress, etc., and the media. But on the other hand, there is so much consensus in this country, if you look from Europe. Consensus with respect to the role of the state, with the role of government. I mean, on both sides of the aisle, you have a lot of distrust with respect to the role of the government. And the only real social movement responding to the recent crisis is the Tea Party movement, which again centers on reducing the role of the state. And what Obama tried, this healthcare reform, is certainly modest if measured by anything we have here in Europe. But it's called socialist and even communist. And now it's step by step dismantled by the courts or by the single states who get exceptions. Now, I mean, we have to keep that in mind, that these differences between the United States and Europe are tremendous. And they are not decreasing, I see, at all. Nevertheless, the problems we discuss are not anymore solvable on the national level only. We never can get a global solution right away, I completely agree. And if those who say we only can solve these problems globally, that's also a self-excuse for doing nothing sometimes, because we don't have a global government. But there are steps to be taken. Just one, not a concrete, but a general remark. I think that if you see the history of capitalism over the last 200 years or so, it has changed a lot. It partly has changed through crisis. After 1929 and so on, it was not only fascism and war which came out, but it was also the New Deal or the general theory of Keynes. And in 1873, the crisis had a tremendous impact in many European and American economies, and some steps towards a more organized, more coordinated capitalism were the consequence. Now, I don't see much of that. Where are the productive responses to the recent crisis? There are a few steps, Basel, 2 and 3, things like that. But basically, you need a lot of capitalismus kritik. You need a lot of criticism of capitalism turned into a social force in order to invite or even compel the capitalist actors to reform. They never do it alone. They need help. to reform themselves in order to survive. It's that serious.
Yeah.
And in the moment after 1989, 91, I mean, after the experiences of the 20th century, nobody really sees a clear alternative to capitalism. Mm. We see possibilities of reforming and improving capitalism, but in the recent crisis, nobody really offered an alternative to the capitalist system. But we need a lot of these sometimes utopian criticism, capitalismus kritik, which does not mean anti-capitalism, capitalismus kritik. And we wouldn't, and this is a matter of bottom up, of a lot of discussion, of slow change, and as a consequence, one can hope that one can draw productive consequences of crisis.
Professor, you know, as one of the Americans here in the room, let me speak about this notion of Americans being skewed to the right when they think about the role of the state. If you look at all polls that have been done in the last year or two, when Americans are asked, what do you want to be cut more? Do you want the national debt to be cut? Do you want Social Security to be cut? Or do you want Medicare to be cut? Almost every time, the thing that Americans want to be touched is Social Security. Americans want Social Security to remain intact no matter how in debt the nation is, no matter how bad things are for the U.S. economy. That one social entitlement is something that Americans want preserved. Now, that speaks to the notion of a desire for a social welfare network or apparatus to remain in the United States, and that speaks also for the role of the state. I think the problem in the United States is Americans are schizophrenic, much more so than Europeans. Europeans embrace the state and say the state is a good thing. Americans are always cursing the state, but at the same time are first in line for social entitlements. And it's that dichotomy in thinking that is one thing that differentiates Americans from Europeans. We hate the state, but we love your check. I think we've got time for maybe one question, and then we're going to have to wrap it up. The gentleman here.
Oliver Steinmetz, co-founder and founding president of this alumni association. Very happy and proud to see the number 25 now here on the screen. This is about shaping a changing world, about the future, and all the challenges that await us in doing that. And I was wondering, we've talked a lot about, and you've talked a lot about the, well, obviously about the past. The history professor has to do that, as you said, and what we can learn from that. We have a challenge now that is more, I mean, what I see personally as the main challenge for the future is climate change. And that we, my thinking in that area is, have we finally reached the level of maturity of humankind that we can stop bickering between nations and stop talking about national security and start talking about human security, or even planet security, because, well, nature security and all that. And is that, let's say, I would like to see your views a bit about that, because we can talk about financial systems, we can talk about political systems, it's all nice, and about corporate systems. And are there any ideas how to put this all to work to make us manage to do the transition from let's say what I call old thinking and old energy to new thinking in that area? Would be interested to hear your thoughts about that. Thank you.
Okay, can we start at the end with Hassan? Let's just work our way.
Well, I think it's the old system. We've been talking about capitalism and the excesses of capitalism, and climate change touches the most important economy in the world, is the United States economy. And the interests are financial, and the decisions that need to be made to correct climate change so that, I mean, the effect will be 20 years from now, 25 years from now, are unacceptable to in this mindset of financial. So they resist. It's simply because they understand only the immediate, whereas you guys in Europe and everywhere else, you see, you're trying to protect your children. But even in America, look at how many extreme phenomena happened. Just this past 2 weeks in Alabama, just 30 or 40 hurricanes in the same day, destroying entire towns. This is going to happen more and more flooding Australia all this year, more and more extreme phenomena, and then they'll have to understand. the government would have to intervene to make them accept decisions that are hard to accept now.
Well, I'm not an expert about the climate change. However, I have a feeling it has much common with the wealth and with the money spent. But coming to the some Polish examples, in some regions in Poland, we do not have many trees, just because of the agricultural processes, they were cut. And in those regions, we can see that the ground is drying, and additionally, we have significantly more hurricanes there. So it means that this example shows that it's not that difficult to establish a program that would allow just to grow trees in some regions, maybe in a Also, I was also, for example, studying in Missouri. In Missouri, that is in the middle of the states. And in the past, in this region, there were also quite a lot of trees. And in the past, there were significantly less hurricanes as well. So maybe, well, Poland is a smaller country, smaller hurricanes. United States, bigger one. But maybe, and I am not an expert about the climate, but I have one single observation, maybe you have more. Thank you very much.
My answer to that question is quite simple. The problem is a political one, and it won't be solved until you convince people that it's economically advantageous to fix climate change.
I would even be a little bit more precise. The problem is not even a political one, it's a problem of Washington or of the political class in Washington. Yes, I must say this, because I make totally different experiences when I go to California. We have this organization of big cities. American cities are part of this organization. Cities who really undertook a lot of efforts to decrease CO2 emissions, for example, and so it's really a problem of a certain class of politicians. That is first point. First, second point: the international pressure will increase drastically over the next couple of years. I'm convinced about that because, especially the Asian countries, realize the effects of climate change. Meanwhile, quite heavily. And the US does it partly, but not East Coast, Northeast Coast so much as other parts of the US. The Asian countries realize it very drastically, and they increase their international efforts to come to an agreement to set up stronger regulations. And third point, it is economically advantage. It is an advantage, and our industry already, you know, has felt the effect. And part of our very successful, outcome of the financial crisis is due to our efforts we have undertaken in research and development 10 years ago and so on, in order, for example, to increase the quality of our machinery industry, to increase energy efficiency, but also, for example, to set up a very successful development of green technologies, as we call it, renewables, but not only renewables, but green technology in general. And that is one of the major factors why our industry is so successful worldwide. And the American industry suffers. They suffer because they didn't undertake these strong, efforts to improve the quality of their machinery industry, for example. And that is a disadvantage, meanwhile. And they realize this, meanwhile, but they are not. This part of the industry is not strong enough, to pursue their interest at the moment in Washington, at the Capitol. And therefore, the Americans, the industry also has to, I think, reconsider how can they push their interests much more strongly than they did during the last couple of years. So there are three points why it's much more advantage. It has much more advantages to really stress this point, to use climate change as a way to modernize your society.
I agree with that, but I just want to say this quick thing, and that is that the ordinary Australian voter thinks that climate change policy will make them poorer.
Yeah. And, well, there's no doubt that a great deal of responsibility is in Washington. But also, Washington is under the thrall, under the control of corporations such as British Petroleum, which are multinational. And despite this tremendous crisis in the Gulf, the Congress is now going to authorize them to continue drilling. Despite the fact it's been proven that the technology for drilling was not for so deep. They do not have a technology yet in place. Until we can put a control on the undue influence, because they have the congressmen bought, the senators, the big climate deniers, Inhofe, and a former Fulbrighter from Oklahoma as well, who's a senator. Despite his Oxford education, he still is a consistent, they resist because they're vested. The Congress is made up of millionaires who have stock in these companies. And the lobbies have unfettered access to them. They, after they serve their terms in Congress, they go work for the lobbies. It is a very, very difficult political situation. I don't see it as extreme. Sure, the corporations, at least some of the corporations, see where the future is. And so they're investing in Europe. They're investing in green. But in America, so many of these corporations are conservative because they want the quick profit now. Corporations are to make profit. They don't care what the consequences are. And this is a grave crisis in America. And that's, again, why we must pressure our representatives. We must pressure these corporations. It's got to be people power. And I'm afraid it's usually crisis that move us to action.
Okay, Professor.
Well, I guess I disagree. And I think it's too simple.
Do you get a salary from someone?
Well, that's part of the problem. It's also a very democratic country. And these senators and these congressmen and women are elected. They want to be reelected. They go back into their voting district frequently. And money is tremendously important there. And much too important in the elections and the campaigns. But, you know, doesn't explain everything. Recently, the governorship in California was not won by the rich person who put in, I don't know, billions into her campaign, but by Governor Brown, who got the votes. And it's a relatively democratic country. Public opinion counts. And with respect to climate, you have much less attention to these problems than here. Perhaps not in California, but in most parts of the United States. And if I may add one thing which is lacking this morning and now, the military side. I mean, we talk about the role of the state and the future and about European-American differences. The United States, if I don't get the figures wrong, 43% of all military expenditures in the world is on the side of the United States. 5% of the population is in the United States. It's a tremendous consensus about the importance of the military on both sides in the United States, very much in contrast to here. I do not want to judge this now. It's a very complicated thing, and some people argue we can afford in Europe here to be so far away from the military because they do this. So it's a complicated thing. We should keep it in mind, and if we are interested in European-American differences, here is a major one. And again, it's not a matter of corporations and the military industrial complex alone. It's partly, yes. But to a large extent, it's also in the opinion polls. They don't want to touch the armies and the Navy and the military services. And again, it is also a bottom-up movement, not only a matter of the elites and the corporations.